You are listening to BensTorah.com.
When it comes to, for instance, a rabbinical holiday like the concept of Purim, is that there is really one major miracle that took place that caused the Yontov of Purim to come into existence. The miracle I'm referring to is the salvation of the Jewish people that Hashem caused to happen through the agency of Mordechai and Esther, and through the ultimate influence they had upon Ahasuerus, that he should change the gezeros of genocide against the Jews, and allow the Jews to have the upper hand, and ultimately to win any wars against the anti-Semites or the Amalekim of the Persian Empire, and to militarily defeat them. And only was that a benefit of the miracle of Purim, but Klal Yisrael once again were mekabel, like they did by Har Sinai, Torah Shebikhtav and Torah Shebaal-Peh. As the Gemara says, Kibul Masha, Kibul Kavar, they were mekabel once again with the mekabel many, many years ago. And one other major benefit of the Yom Tov of Purim was the fact that the head of the Persian Empire at that time, Dayavish number two, Darius number two, was the Persian emperor and king and the most powerful man in the world, to therefore help the Jews return to Eretz Israel, rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, gave them the money they need, the materials they need, and the security they needed to establish the second Commonwealth of Eretz Israel with the building of the second temple. In fact, one of the ways the Jews showed a Hakaras HaTov to the Persian Empire for their help in facilitating that specific redemption of the Jews was having on the front gate, the eastern gate of the Beis HaMikdash, a plaque that was carved out with the picture of Shushan HaBira, the capital of Persia, showing the Persians were makatov for all that they did to help us, not only in helping us save ourselves, but also giving us the ability to return to Eretz Israel and to rebuild our second temple and establish the period of the second temple period. But there was only one miracle. The miracle was the salvation of the Jews from the various nefarious efforts of Haman and all the other anti-Semites of the Persian Empire that wanted to destroy us. Instead of us being destroyed, they were destroyed. As the pasuk says, Napechu, the whole situation was turned upside down. But there was just one miracle bringing this Yom Tov into existence. What is unusual and what is strange is that when you look in the Gemara and Shabbos that describes the miracles that brought the Yom Tov of Chanukah into existence, there are two miracles that are mentioned in the Gemara and Masechta Shabbos. One is the miracle of the Nitzach HaMilchama, the military victory that the Jews had against the Seleucid Greek Empire, which was a miracle in its own right. I mean, the Greek Empire was perhaps one of the most powerful military entities in the world at that point in time. The famous Empire of Alexander the Great, the Greeks were conquering the world, and all of a sudden the Jews were taking on the Greek Empire and successfully were able to eradicate their sphere of influence on the Jewish people. They were able to retake the Beis HaMikdash from the priests of the Greek Empire who wanted to make it into a Hellenistic temple and repurify the temple and do whatever has to be done in building a new Mizbeach, creating a new menorah, lighting the lights again, bringing karbanos. There was a total revamping of the Beis HaMikdash back to a place of Kedusha Vatara, of sanctity and purity, with temple purity standards. We were able to kick out the Seleucid Greeks from there and ultimately eliminated the ultimate threat that the Greek Empire had against the Jewish people. I mean, the Chashmonaim and his sons and all the other freedom fighters who joined in the fight did a miraculous type of salvation with the help of God. Such a miracle alone should be no less than the miracle the Jews had when they came to Purim. But we find the Gemara tells us that besides the miracle of the Nitzach HaMilchama, the military victory against the Greek Empire, there was a need, as the Gemara seems to imply, for miracle number two. And that miracle number two, for those who want me to mention it very explicitly to remind everybody, was that when they came to relight the brand new menorah which they created, because the other one had been defiled, unfortunately, by the Greeks who were there, they built a brand new menorah, but they only found one little crucible of oil that was able to give enough oil in all of the candles on the menorah, which were seven candles, seven receptacles for candlelight, in this case olive oil light, which would last only one day. And lo and behold, God performed a miracle for them. And this crucible of oil was able, once it was poured into the separate shafts that house the oil compartment with the wick to light this type of candle, it lasted not just for one day, it lasted for 8 days. So that was the miracle of the lighting of the menorah lasting longer than it physically, capably was able to do based upon the quantity of oil that was placed into the menorah. That is the second major miracle that took place. And when you have both of these miracles together, the ultimate Yom Tov of Chanukah was officially declared the year after all of these miracles. And that's our observance of Chanukah based upon rabbinical takanot to this very day. If you will notice, it's interesting and fascinating that when it comes to what we physically do to try to recreate the ness of the menorah, we have a halachic mandate rabbinically to light candles, Chanukah candles, each and every night. Machlokas Beis Hillel Beis Shammai, where you start with eight and go down to one, or you start with one and you build up to eight. I'm not going to go into that controversy now. But by lighting candles, we're trying to recreate the miracle of the menorah lasting for a long period of time. We don't recreate the warfare miracle because we usually don't play war games, even by Purim, to try to recreate the milchama that took place between the Jews and the anti-Semites of Persia, nor the anti-Semites of the Greek army. We don't have that type of activity performed by us. But one thing is fascinating, which I think you have to take into consideration now, is that in our tefillot, and this is extremely important, in the tefillot that we recite when it comes to the Shemona Esrei, during the period of the 8 days of Chanukah, we do add in an Alanisim prayer, where we're talking about primarily the Nitzach and the miracle of the war that we had against the Seleucid Greek army. And that Alanisim is not only mentioned in the Shemona Esrei three times a day, but it is also mentioned in our Birchat HaMazon as well. And what is really fascinating and what has always been an interesting question posed by many of the Gedolei HaPoskim, the miracle of the Nitzach HaMelchama is mentioned in the Alanisim. The miracle of a menorah burning 8 days miraculously is never mentioned as an actual miracle. It just says in the Alhanisim, when you look it up later on, that we were able to purify the Beis HaMikdash and ultimately light the menorah once again, etc. and etc. But that the lighting of the menorah and lasting 8 days is not mentioned as an actual miracle in the actual Alhanisim. The only miracle mentioned in the Alhanisim is the miracle of how a few people of a small army were able to defeat a mighty empire, the empire of the Seleucid Greek army, a very powerful international army with incredible capacities. We defeated them, and we had Nitzach HaMelchama. That's what's emphasized in our tefillos. And if you think about it for a couple of minutes, it's quite fascinating because the tefillos of Hodah, thankfulness to Hashem, is highlighting the Nitzach HaMelchama. The same way the Alanisim on Purim is highlighting the Nitzach HaMelchama against the anti-Semites of the Persian Empire. But the miracle of the actual menorah is not mentioned in the Al HaNisim, but the way we actually are publicizing that miracle is by physically lighting Neros in our homes, each and every one of us, during the 8 days of Hanukkah. That's the way we publicize the miracle of the menorah, by doing that activity in our homes for 8 days in a row. But the question begs itself, why do we therefore need the miracle of the menorah? The miracle of the Nitzach and Melchama should have been sufficient to make the Yontov of Hanukkah, the same way the Nitzachon of the Jews during the Persian Empire and the time of the Purim miracle only needed the Nitzach and Melchama to make the Yontov of Purim. Why is Hanukkah different? What's the need of these two miracles? And I hope today to get into this topic as quickly as possible and try to answer it within the time limited. If we don't finish today, I'll finish it next week. But I want you to hear some major questions now, even when it comes to the military intervention that we had against the Greek army. There's a major difference, and I want to emphasize this upfront, between our military intervention with the Persian anti-Semites and the Amalekim of that empire, that we got involved in a warfare against them, in comparison to the military engagement we had with the Greek Empire. What's the difference? I want you to think about this, because many people don't think about what I'm going to tell you now. If you read the narrative of the Megillus Esther very carefully, our ability to intervene in the Persian Empire and have an open warfare with the anti-Semitic personalities of the Persian Empire, Haman could obviously was number one, enemy number one, but there were many anti-Semites, which numbers are listed later on of how many people were killed from the anti-Semites of the Persian Empire that were really ideologically of the Amalek camp who wanted to destroy the Jews. There, we basically defeated them. Well, people forget is that we had a royal edict signed and sealed and delivered by the head of the Persian Empire, where he empowered Mordechai and Esther and the Jews to make an open warfare against the anti-Semites of that empire. So we had the jurisdiction of the Persian emperor and the empire to fight that war. So we weren't going to have any other non-Jews or the Persian army preventing us. They were encouraging us. They were giving us the permission to undergo this type of warfare and succeed and defeat our enemies. Fascinating case scenario. It was supported by the most powerful nation on the face of that earth, and that is the Persian Empire at that historical point in time. They gave us the right and the permissibility legally to fight the war and to defeat our adversaries. When it came to the war against the Seleucid Greeks, we didn't have that type of situation. We were taken over by the Greek Empire, who wanted to make the entire Jewish nation into a Hellenistic type of religion. There was no Geisha king to go to ask for permission to fight these Hellenists that were basically Greek Hellenists with the help of some Jewish Hellenists who were trying to destroy our religion, Begozer against Shabbos, Prismila, and other major rituals, tried to get rid of Judaism and replace it with Hellenistic ideas and Hellenistic rituals in their pagan holiday. When we fought the war, we didn't have permission from any major emperor or king or personality in the non-Jewish world giving us permission to fight this war. It was a war that was fought by people who fought for the salvation of Jews and Judaism. They risked their lives. And ironically speaking, this war was really, if you think about it, a super duper miracle just in the actual warfare, because we had a bunch of Kohanim and their group of people that joined them, who are not professional military people. They have not trained to be military people their entire life. They were private citizens who were literally infuriated by the fact that religion of Judaism was being eradicated by the Greek Empire, the conquering empire, and they were doing whatever they possibly could do to destroy Judaism, to defile our temple, make it into a pagan temple, and to prevent us even from circumcising our children and performing normal mitzvahs, which were done by the Jews on an everyday basis itself. We took on a war on our own accord, without any permission of any king or monarch that was a powerful entity of that time. We were fighting the most powerful kingdom of that time. And miraculously, we succeeded in that war. Hanukkah, therefore, if you think about it for a couple of minutes, was a super-duper military victory, which the Jews waged themselves without help from any other non-Jewish entity helping us do it or giving a sanction to do it. And we won that war. The Gemara just says, V'natzchum. We were able to literally beat out the Seleucid Greeks in a war confrontation, get basically the ability to take back our temple and purify it and continue our religious observance and once again give Klal Yisrael ability of freedom of religion in the land of Eretz Israel, in our Jewish homeland. From a miracle perspective, the warfare we had by Hanukkah is much more powerful miracle than the miracle of the warfare we had by Purim. But that therefore makes the question even more difficult. Why therefore did we need a second miracle of the burning of the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash miraculously for 8 days? The warfare alone should have been a super-duper miracle to mechayev us in celebrating this as a Yom Tov. Very, very, it's a very, very big question. And number two, what's even more problematic is that the tefillas we recite, the Al Hanisim, is really accentuating the military victory, which was a tremendous ness. And even the Hallel that we recite on the Yom Tov of Hanukkah, Chazal tell us, the Maral Miprag says, is not commemorating the ness of the burning of the oil in the Beis HaMikdash of the menorah. The Hallel we recite is the salvation we had from the Greek army in our military victory. The Tfilos themselves, in their essence, are Harodot Hashem because of the military victory. So even that phenomenon of the tefillos we recite and the nusach tefillos and the reason we recite Hallel is all geared vis-a-vis a supernatural type of miracle, and that is the miracle of our nitzachon against the ultimate Greek empire itself. But I want to ask another question. Did the Jews have a right to make a war against the Seleucid Greek army if strategically people might claim that this was an act of war that would be a war really that seems to be suicidal in nature? Are you allowed to undertake a war that's a suicide war? By Purim, it wasn't a suicide war because you had enough Jews in the empire and the royal sanction of the Persian emperor to fight that war. And they had enough people there with arms and capacities to take care of the anti-Semites. In the war of Hanukkah, we were surely outnumbered in every way possible, in numbers of people, in professional strategies of professional soldiers fighting us, in the armaments they were using, the major animals that were part of their war machine, these gigantic elephants and such. This was a very, very difficult war to fight. And if a person was a military strategist, they would say, this war looks like a potential suicide mission. Why am I saying that? Because Chazal point out that when Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, who lived during the end of the Second Temple period, was confronted with the Roman legions surrounding Yerushalayim from all sides, ready to attack the city, to kill the Jews inside, Rachmana Litzlan, to destroy the actual Beis HaMikdash, and literally burn it to the ground. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai at the end didn't say, let's just fight to the last man. He went out secretly to negotiate a deal with the head of the army at that point in time and was able to negotiate some type of form of a peace treaty that those individuals who were willing to surrender and not fight would be allowed to leave Yerushalayim and reestablish the Sanhedrin someplace else in Kerem Biyavna, and a whole bunch of other things he was able to negotiate. But he did not say, let's just fight to the last man because we have to defend Yerushalayim. And the reason he didn't is because many Mefarshim say, since he saw it was literally a suicide mission, to think that the number of Jews in Yerushalayim could be able to withstand the onslaught of the major Roman army that was surrounding Yerushalayim and surrounding the Beis HaMikdash, it's impossible, but Derech HaTeva to fight them, he felt it's better to negotiate some type of peace settlement rather than have a war to the last man. So we see that you're allowed to negotiate a peace when you see it's a suicide mission. Why did the Jews and the Kohanim, when it came to the Hanukkah miracle, feel that what they're doing is not a suicide mission? This is the million-dollar question everybody asks. Okay? And what I want to share with you today as the basic entree into this topic is a very interesting pshat that is offered by none other than the great Gadol, the Chassam Sofer of Moshe Sofer, the Gadol of the Hungarian community and the world Jewish community, the Gadol Hador of the 1800s. And this Chassam Sofer points out a very interesting answer to this question. He points out we have a minhag in Klal Yisrael that Chanukah always turns out in our Jewish calendar around Parshas Vayeshev and Parshas Miketz. And there's a certain symbolic connection between the events that took place in these Parshas HaShavua and the Yom Tov of Chanukah. And when we understand what took place in these parashios, hashkafically and practically, you'll then be able to understand the answer to this question I just posed, of how we dare to take a war that seemed to be an impossible war and try to destroy this Seleucid Greek army that was attacking us and think we had the possibility of succeeding benitzachon against these individuals. The following is what the Chassam Sofer points out. He says, if you look very carefully in the episode in Parshas Vayeshev, the personality that is the highlight of the Parshas Vayeshev is a young man who we call today Yosef HaTzadik. Yosef was one of the youngest brothers of the 12 brothers. He was the first of the two sons that Rachel gave birth to for her husband to Yaakov. The other son was Binyamin. And this Yosef HaTzadik, for reasons which I'm not going to go into now, Barichos, was not in the good graces of his other brothers. And for that reason, they felt he was a troublemaker for their misconception of what Yosef was doing, and sold him as a prisoner to be taken down to Egypt, to be sold as a slave, out of sight, out of mind. He's not going to cause us problems anymore. And that's the case scenario we find in the beginning of Parshas Yeshev, and him being brought down to the Egyptian Empire by Yishma'elim, who are basically merchants, and selling him to one of the most powerful personages in Egypt at that time, a person who is called Potipera. He was the Sahat Abachim. He was the minister in charge of life and death in Egypt. He was the executioner when people had to be punished for crimes against the king and the empire. He's the one who exacted punishment, Rav HaTabachim. Tabachim means a professional murderer. And that's the person he was sold to, and the person in whose house he was living in his initial entree into the Egyptian empire. The fact of the matter is, Yosef was a very young man at that point in time. And there's no question he must have been in tremendous fear for his life.
You are listening to BensTorah.com.
That he's a slave now being sold to one of the most vicious people in the entire Egyptian empire. But what we see happening, quite interesting and fascinating, as we start looking at Parshas Vayeshev, is an interesting story being told to us, which sounds almost surreal. It tells us that this Yosef was appointed by the head of this household, his Adon HaMitzri, to take care of various house duties. And it says that he was an Ish Matzliach, that Yosef was very successful working for this Ish Mitzri, this Potipera. And it says that Hashem was with Yosef. And then it tells us that the head of the household saw Ki Hashem Ito, that Yosef had his God continuously helping him in all the tasks that were thrown upon Yosef to do. Kol HaShe'osa Hashem HaSliach Bidodo. Whatever specific task was given over to this Yosef, God gave divine assistance, Siyata Deshmaya, to Yosef, that he should succeed in every task that he was charged to perform. And it seems to even be more interesting over here. V'yimzi Yosef chein b'enov. Yosef found grace in the eyes of this Rav HaTabachim. It's hard to believe a guy who's a hardcore murderer and executioner would have chein for any human being. But Yosef found chein, grace in his eyes. And not only that, he then appointed Yosef v'yefachadeh abeso. He told Yosef, you're such a trusty guy. You're such a successful guy. I'm putting everything that I have under your control. You're now the head of the household when it comes to functional daily activities. It's unbelievable. Yosef all of a sudden is becoming a personage in the house of the most powerful man in Egypt besides that of the king. And Chazal tell us that everything that Yosef did from the time he was given this appointment, Hashem blessed the house of the Mitzri because of Yosef's activity. Birchas Hashem was all that Yosef did. And could obviously, he basically let Yosef have total control, did not ask him to give him any accounting. He trusted this Yosef. So the question everybody asks, it seems that this Mitzri is starting to believe that there's a God of Yosef that you have to reckon with. How did this idolater, this Rav HaTabachim, start to believe in the God of Yosef? What made him believe in the God of Yosef? What made him even recognize there was a God of Yosef? So Rashi says, you know how this Mitzri, this Rav HaTabachim, knew there's a God of Yosef? Because Yosef was a very, very pious young man, a very humble young man. And every time he succeeded in one of the jobs that he was given to do, you know what he did? He said to his master, it's not just me who is doing what I have to do to make you succeed, and that I should be able to carry out all the things you give me to do. He used to say, Baruch Hashem, thank the Lord, my God. He mentioned God's name. God enabled me to succeed and do what you want me to do. He brought God's name into the vernacular of this specific Egyptian. So any time Yosef succeeded, Yosef would say, Baruch Hashem, my God, help me do this, help me do that. Gave me the ability to give you success in this activity and that activity. So slowly but surely, Yosef HaTzadik brought the essence of God and the power of God, the omnipotent power of God, which he claims enabled him, into the life, into the mental awareness of this Ish-Mitzri. It's fascinating. I mean, there was like a Kiddush Hashem over here. All that I do is because my God helps me, and I succeed, and I help you. That's causing a Kiddush Hashem, giving God all the ultimate statement of, he is the cause. He is the entity that makes me succeed, and it's good for you. He brought God into the life and into the mindset of this idolater who worshiped many other gods, which quite obviously didn't do so much for him as Yosef's God did for him. In any event, this is how the story starts off. But then it gets very rough. And when I say very rough, we now are exposed to another major dimension of Egypt. The Torah says in various places, and especially in Parshas Achrimos, it says over there in the 18th chapter, that one of the notorious phenomena that exist in Egypt, which happened to be at that time the superpower of the world militarily, the superpower of the world when it came to the sciences of that time, the superpower when it came to technology, the superpower when it came to worshiping the most deities that any other nation worship on the face of this earth. It was in ancient history, not only the place where the cradle of civilization, where everything was taking place, commerce and technology and everything else, but Egypt was the very, very heart of the world, the inhabited world, when it comes to a powerful, powerful kingdom. This place, Egypt, despite all of its sophistication and all these wonderful areas, was known to be full of incredible promiscuity. The entire nation was full of all different types of sexual activities. All of them, by definition, the way what they were doing, were totally improper. The Torah criticizes Egypt many times as being the superpower for all the sexual promiscuous things taking place in the world. What they did there was filtered out and practiced by other nations as well. And this poor Yosef HaTzadik, who came from a very sheltered, spiritually pure and proper family, was now subject to a culture that was a total opposite of what he was used to up until this point in time, being a sheltered young man in the house of a tzaddik and tzaddikis his entire life. True, he was exposed momentarily as a young child, as a little baby, to love him, but he was too young at that point in time to really have that much of love in what he did, have that much impact upon him, even though Lovin also was an idolatrous personality who wasn't very, very proper when it comes to the things I just mentioned. But Egypt was notorious. And this Yosef HaTzadik now is being thrown into an empire, surrounded by the tumah of Arayot from all different directions. And the Torah now sets up what is the major nesayin of Yosef he's going to be confronting now in Parshas Vayeshev. The Torah says that when Yosef became such a powerful master of the household of this Ish-Mitzri, and the Egyptian master said to Yosef, I trust you, you don't have to give me any din v'cheshbon. It also mentions that this Yosef was Yafas Toa, Yafei Mara. He was a very handsome and attractive young man. He was young, successful, nice Jewish boy, proper manners, handsome, and also quite obviously somebody who, when you saw him, you said, wow, what a put together, beautiful, handsome young man this was. So you'll say, so what's the big deal? What happens next shows you what a big deal this is. V'achad devar me'ela, the Torah tells us, V'atisa eishes Adonav ezeinel Yosef, V'atova shichva imi. Adultery was looked upon as nothing in Egypt. Everybody was committing adultery, the husbands, the wives, everybody was in promiscuity. And the wife of this Potipera, she saw a nice, handsome young man in the house, who knows how many years younger he was than her older husband. So she went over to him when she had nobody around and solicited from him that he should commit adultery with her. She's married to the Egyptian master, and she wanted this young man to commit adultery with her. What is Yosef's answer to her? Vayamo'ein. He definitively, with a loud voice, refused with tremendous emphasis. And he said to her, to this woman, what are you talking about? Your husband has so much trust in me. He never asks me questions to give him a din v'cheshbon and what I'm doing. All that he has, kol asher yesh lo, he gave under my supervision. There's nobody in the household that has more power than me when it comes to taking care of the affairs of the household. He has not held back anything from my supervision and control, except one thing. You, his wife, are off limits. At Ishto, you're his wife. I don't have any ownership or any supervision upon you. Eich eseh haraha gdol hazeh. I'm going to now commit an act that you're asking me to do with you and literally show total disrespect to your husband, my master. And besides that, sin against my God who prohibits such inappropriate sexual activity. What are you talking about? The Chumash tells us that despite the drasha that Yosef made, Dabra Yosef Yom Yom, she drove him crazy privately every day. Lo shama la lishka v'hulios, that's the only more. She tried every way to convince him to break his morality and to do sexual things with her. Yosef refused each and every day. The Gemara in Tereshva tells us she had an endless wardrobe available to her. A wardrobe, perfumes, all different types of sexual-oriented clothing which she would put on. She wore a special type of clothing for breakfast, another one for lunch, another one for supper. She tried to entice him every way she possibly could. Chazal tell us that when he showed total defiance, she then said to him, remember, my husband is the Rav HaTabachim. If you don't listen to me, I'll lie about what you did behind his back, make a big lie, and he can kill you on the spot. He can torture you. He's the Rav HaTabachim. So I can be good to you if you commit yourself to commit immorality with me. I can be very bad to you if you refuse. So Yosef was in a very, very difficult situation. As the drama of the Pasha continues, we now come to a very serious situation. There was a pagan holiday that was observed in Egypt, one of the most important holidays of the year, where everybody ran to their local idolatrous church to pray to their deity. The whole household, lock, stock, and barrel, ran. The Adon of the house never required Yosef, since he believed in a different God, to have to worship idolatry, thank God. He respected Yosef, and he respected Yosef's God, so he wouldn't make Yosef do that. And Yosef, therefore, on the day that everybody ran to their idolatrous church, came to the house to take care of his normal duties. But his wife, who should have gone to the idolatrous church with her husband and everybody else, feigned sickness that day and told her husband and all the servants, "I'm sick in bed, I can't go, I don't feel well." So she was absolved from that responsibility. "You're sick in bed, we're not going to make you go sick." And she was allowed to sleep in bed and stay there. They left medicines for her and other stuff and food. And she basically made believe she can't even get out of bed. And she can't surely walk to that church of the idol. So she was home. And when Yosef came to what he thought to be an empty house, lo and behold, he saw that he was stuck there now with the wife of this idolater who pretended to be sick to everybody else. But when Yosef came to the palace and nobody else was there, she basically said to him, "Guess what? Nobody's here in the house, and therefore I want to live with you. I want to have a sexual union with you." Vatispaseu bibigdo. She grabbed his outer cloak, that he was wearing on the outside of his body. Shichvei mi. I want you to submit to me. And the Torah tells us, Vayazov bigdo biyodo, since the outer clothing, his outer coat, he could slip out of it quickly. He slipped out of that coat. Vayonas v'yetza chutzei, he ran out. And she was holding the beged of Yosef's outer clothing in her hand. Aza bigdo biyodo vayonas achutza. What did this machshefa do? She ultimately called the members of the household that came back early from this pagan holiday in their church, and she told them what the Jewish boy tried to do. He tried to rape her, she says, and she was screaming and yelling. Nobody there was helping her. But ultimately speaking, as I screamed and I screamed, he got scared. He left his beged that he had taken off in my hand, and he went outside. She said the story over a couple of times. When her husband came home, she made up this bubba meinza that the guy that you left here to take care of your household tried to rape me. This eved her ivri. I screamed and I yelled. He ran out. This is the beged. And once again, she tried to get her husband to get so angry at this young man, he would kill him, execute him as being the Rav HaTabachim. So this young man would never even have a chance to tell his story and tell the husband that he wasn't trying to rape her, she was trying to rape him, get rid of the evidence and save her marriage, and the husband shouldn't get angry at her. What's fascinating, and this the Chassam Sofer says, is the expression Vayonos Vayetza Chutz is mentioned totally approximately 4 times in the narrative over here. So the question the Chassam Sofer asks, how did Yosef, a young boy, have the courage, have the willpower, have the capacity to not be fearful for his life? How did he have the ability not to succumb to his Yetzer Hara? He was in a state of yichud with a woman who was very powerful and very beautiful and was putting on all types of perfume and doing all types of things to seduce him. How did he withstand her? How did he have the capacity to do this? And the Torah tells us Vayonis v'yetzah chutzah, he ran outside and he escaped. How do you have the ability to literally not sin over here? So Rashi comments, what saved Yosef HaTzadik is he saw in his mind, as he saw this Nisayim playing out, he saw the Mustiukno Shalaviv. The image of his father, of Yaakov, came to his mind. He saw the image of Yaakov, and upon seeing that image, it gave him the inner strength to withstand all of the temptations and the seductions taking place, to run out of the palace of his Adon and to save himself from committing a terrible sin against this man who is his Adon, who treated him well, and more importantly, against HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This is what Chazal say is what saved Yosef HaTzadik. In fact, he's called Yosef HaTzadik because the tzidkus of how he was able to prevent himself from falling into this trap and sinning was a tremendous act of tzidkus, of righteousness on his part. Many other people faced with the same assignment would not be able to withstand what he was able to withstand. And his ability to withstand all of this and to save himself and not sin, he therefore earned the appellation to be called Yosef HaTzadik, Yosef the Righteous One. He's mechayev all the other people in the world who were not able to do what he did. He's mechayev harashayim, and he basically is matzdik people who are tzadikim, who would have done what he did, and raised their reputation and made it into a sign of spiritual and physical strength and a role model example to each and every one of us. The question that Chassam Sofer asks, and this is the point I'm going to end off with today to set the tone for next week's shiur, why is it that when he saw his father's image, the Mustikin of Shalaviv, it allowed him to persevere and not succumb to this seduction? Many people can see pictures of their forefathers. Many people have pictures of tzaddikim, tzidkanios, going back grandfathers and great-grandfathers and great-grandmothers. But unfortunately, in the way of the world, these pictures don't always save their children or grandchildren from forsaking religion and not doing mitzvahs, converting, assimilating, acculturating. Pictures don't seem to have that type of power. What is the meaning he saw the demus deyukno of his father, which is also an unusual expression? Usually pictures are portrayed to be a temuna, a pictorial representation of somebody. Demus deyukno sh'aviv means more than just a picture. It means he saw something about the lifestyle and the hashkafa of Yaakov and what he stood for and what was the incredible power that Yaakov used to succeed in overcoming all of his adversaries, including Lav and Harasha, that wanted, as the Haggadah say, Lakas Akol, to destroy everything that Yaakov did or wanted to accomplish. He wanted to cause assimilation and destruction spiritually of Yaakov and his wives, his daughters, and his children's grandchildren. Yeah, it says in the Haggadah, Lavan Bikesh Lakas Akol, but he didn't accomplish it. We have to analyze next week what was the power of the Demus Deyukno of Yaakov, that secret power that energized Yaakov to withstand, that now Yosef seemed to possess, that allowed him also to succeed and to withstand everything being thrown at him and to remain Yosef HaTzadik. I'm going to stop over here. Next week we're going to continue with an incredible prolonged analysis of this question. And by the time I finish next week, you'll have an answer to all the questions I posed in the beginning of this year today. What is the thrust of the Hanukkah miracle? How did Klaus have the chutzpah to fight a war against a superpower, the Greeks? Why we needed two miracles, the miracle of the Nitzach HaMelchama, and why we need the miracle, ultimately speaking, of the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash. Stay tuned to next week. We're getting closer to Hanukkah then, and as a good prelude to Hanukkah, you'll have the ending of the story, but an incredible insight to what we learned from Parshas Vayeshev and Miketz, and how this will help us understand the miracle of Hanukkah on a much more deeper level.
You have been listening to a presentation of BensTorah.com.